But I think we're joined now by Professor Tim Anderson. Are you there, sir?
Hi there. How are you, Phil?
Very good, and we're glad to be talking to you. We read your articles in Global Research, and they couldn't be, in my opinion, more timely, all of your writing, frankly, because since this whole thing began to unfold in Syria, I've been reminded that U.S. military over the years had a phrase they were using, which was, they said, in order to win in the new situation of American exceptionalism, et cetera, they said they needed information dominance.
Yeah.
And it strikes me that your articles really speak to this. It's a bit that the crisis, the bloodshed, et cetera, in Syria has had a kind of a storyline, and you've tackled the storyline. And I wonder if we could just start with the one we hear the most often. I hear it from President Obama, and I guess we're going to be hearing more of it as this dangerous situation unfolds. He continually says that the Syrian government of President Assad uses barrel bombs. And he hardly gives a speech without it saying barrel bombs three or four times. And you really go after this in your article, The Dirty War on Syria, Barrel Bombs, Partisan Sources. Where does this story come from? What do you make of that?
I think really it's the latest of a series of slogans that they've been creating. One was peaceful protesters. Remember, 2011, it was peaceful protesters that were being attacked. Then we had the chemical weapons incident. It was gassing children, gassing children.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's barrel bombing. I think Obama actually said that there wasn't even any evidence at all for this, that Assad was deliberately targeting children with barrel bombs or something. The thing about barrel bombs is, it's nothing to do with the technology of the weapon, really. I mean, after all, the U.S. has used white phosphorus and depleted uranium and even atomic weapons against civilians, you know, so it's not really about technology, but it's about finding some new sort of horror story that people don't really understand and repeating it endlessly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the White House has had the support from the boss of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, on this too, just repeating that phrase as though it means something. There's a reporter, Robert Parry, who wrote on this. He said, look, in terms of technology, dropping a bomb, any sort of bomb from a helicopter is going to be a lot more targeted than most other sorts of missile attacks and other sorts of attacks, really. But what it is, it's an attempt to say that the collateral damage, you know, the civilians that are being killed from this new weapon that no one really understands is horrendous. I think the report that got put out by Amnesty International, based on what they called activists, anonymous activists embedded with the Al-Qaeda groups, was a collateral damage rate of 100 to 1, which is, you know, catastrophic. It's like, so it's an attempt to denigrate the Syrian military and say that basically they, you know, they have no right to be doing anything to defend their country against this sort of terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it strikes me as like talking points for the mass of the population. It has a nice alliterative barrel bomb. Sounds horrible. And in point of fact, my understanding, the Syrian government, and I've seen President Assad himself say, why would we use such a? We don't have them. We don't use them. We use weapons that work against an enemy that is armed.
Yeah, well, they don't call them barrel bombs. They don't have anything called barrel bombs, but they do have types of devices that they drop from helicopters. There's no doubt about that. And as I said, they're likely to be more precise. To drop it on a building from a helicopter, vertical from a helicopter, is going to be more precise than a lot of other circumstances. If you looked at all of the sites, and I think, I believe Human Rights Watch, which is really in lockstep with the White House, you know, over this particular conflict, they published a map of where these attacks were supposed to have taken place in northeast Aleppo, and they are all in the areas where the Al-Qaeda groups are. So really, after that, there was there were reports of barrel bombs in Douma, which is an area northeast of Damascus, in country Damascus. Douma has been occupied by Al-Qaeda groups, the Islamic Front, Jabhat al-Nusra, for the last 3 years. It's one of the few areas, like northeast Aleppo and the town of Raqqa. Douma really is pretty much completely taken over by the al-Qaeda groups. The last big evacuation of civilians from Douma was in January this year. A few thousand were brought out by the army. There were video images and other images shown of the army doing that in January this year. But then several months later on, 7 or 8 months later on, we have this story that civilians are being bombed and there's no fighters there and it's only civilians that are in Douma. The Douma is the headquarters of closest to Damascus of those al-Qaeda groups. So the old, change and switch trick of saying that when the al-Qaeda groups themselves are being bombed, they are all civilians. This has been going on from the beginning. It was reported by a number of U.S. reporters too. Neil Rosen, I remember talking about it in 2011, that when the groups themselves are hit, they just go to their favorite media channels and say, or their favorite sources that pass things on to Western media and say these are all civilians.
Yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, that here we are so many years after what happened in the attacks on Iraq, U.S. invasion there, and then the destruction of Libya, and still standing there with a straight face and in suits, etc., Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, as though the public should go to them as reliable sources. Why is that a mistake?
Yeah, well, I mean, Amnesty has a slightly different history. I believe they started in London originally, but you know, Amnesty USA is really effectively dominated by the State Department. You know, the leader of them, the director, a little while back, came straight across from Hillary Clinton's State Department to run some slogans about, I believe the first thing that caught attention was that they put up billboards saying, NATO, keep up the progress in Afghanistan. This is about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they copped a lot of flack for that. So their links to the State Department are incredibly close. Human Rights Watch has always been linked into the Council of Foreign Relations, so the elite foreign policy group in Washington. And I think one thing that confused people a little bit was that they were critical of the Bush administration. The whole movement of the idea of humanitarian intervention has been tied more closely to what's called the liberal side of politics in the U.S. than the realist or the Republican side of politics. You know, hence the difference between the Bush-style direct invasion of Iraq, which, you know, huge numbers of people opposed, and this dirty war. I call it a dirty war with the which is nothing new in U.S. history, of course, but using the humanitarian arguments, it really tends to come more from the Democrat side of politics in the U.S. And so it's reflected in the media, the media that tends to support so-called liberal politics in the U.S. But those organizations you mentioned, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, have played a very important collaborative role with the White House in keeping the myths about this dirty war going.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Tim Anderson, and he is in Sydney, Australia, which, by the way, we're speaking to you Monday afternoon, and we're saying good morning to you Tuesday morning in Australia.
Good morning here.
We still have trouble getting our minds around such things. There's another organization that you really have also dealt well with in your articles, and I find these articles in Global Research elsewhere, but there's an organization called Observatory for the Rights, for Human Rights. It's in London, and all the major journals, and certainly Canada, the U.S., turn to this. I rarely read an article that is a news article from Syria about Syria where they're not cited. But in you say that it's actually one man. That's quite a show.
Yeah, and this has been reported before. It's an extraordinary chronicle of what's happened to Western journalism, I think. Maybe it always happens during a war, but I remember a lot of wars. And if you were a media analyst, and there are some media analysts, you know, pointing this out, but the reliance on one source, which is an obviously partisan source, that's the point I was making in that more recent article about partisan sources and barrel bombs. It's extraordinary that journalists abandon their principles of good practice to always rely on one source that is flying a flag on his website for the armed groups, basically. Now,
the flag of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, he's the Muslim Brotherhood And then his sources are in turn people he talks to.
They don't share that with us. By the way, why doesn't the reporter who tells me that he's quoting this man tell me that he also is he has a Muslim Brotherhood on his website so that I can appreciate or make my own evaluation of him?
Yeah. Well, you can go to his website now and see it for yourself. But they keep relying on this. And then behind that is this, the mythical activist, they keep saying, anonymous activists, really, in many cases, as I said, with the barrel bombs. Now, with their reporting from northeast Aleppo and Douma, northeast Damascus, we know that they are either the people in the al-Qaeda groups themselves or people embedded with them. These are the ones who are running the more recent sort of scare stories, demonizing the Syrian army, saying the Syrian government has no right to defend the country from these mad sectarian terrorists. Mm-hmm. That's really the effect of the barrel bomb stories. Mm-hmm. Is to say the Syrian government, the Syrian army should just surrender to the al-Qaeda groups because you've got no right to attack anyone because we'll just call them civilians. In some respects, it's standard war propaganda, but in other respects, as we were saying, it really, it's a terrible statement about the state of Western journalism that they do get trapped in these single-source reporting.
Yeah, it is very effective. Someone was pointing out recently that among all in the major journals, there's only one individual who seems to stand out at some integrity, and that's Patrick Coburn at The Guardian. I think he's at The Guardian. But, of course, that would be the exception proving the rule.
Even in that case, I think you do have some British reporters like Robert Fisk, mm-hmm. who's at The Independent, and Patrick Coburn. I don't think he's at The Guardian, but anyway, on some level of detail, they've been good, but really they're talking to a British, or let's say an English-speaking audience, which is has great trouble hearing anything different to what they're used to. So their perspectives, to me, are rather distorted. But when it comes to detail, for example, if you see Robert Fisk talking about the detail of something happening in Syria, he's capable of being quite honest about that. But all of the perspectives are very influenced by this idea that, first of all, there is some sort of imperial prerogative in Western countries that they have to somehow solve the problems of Syria. And we know from past history that their problem-solving skills are pretty deficient.
Yes, we're looking at all the bodies of Libya. We're speaking to Tim Anderson, the Global Research, the articles on this matter of failure to produce facts in Western media. And thank heaven these articles by Tim Anderson exist. I'm anxious to know... a story that needs to be told. Actually, you might say the beginning. This matter of what happened. We had a story, by the way, a kind of a storyline established, a narrative. There was a thing called the Arab Spring, and it was slowly moving across the Middle East. And the U.S. State Department was in favor of it. And everywhere there was supposed to be an Arab Spring. And then we said, after Libya was crushed, leaders in the United States, and I remember the leaders of France saying, Assad is next, he ought to go. And then they said, and we have a little Arab Spring going, and it's a peaceful demonstration, and his bad soldiers are shooting at it. Well, again, Tim Anderson, you wrote about this. What in your opinion, happened at the beginning in 2011, which is supposedly the beginning of this whole process?
Yeah, there were indeed political demonstrations and counter-demonstrations because all of these countries are quite different, you understand. Egypt and Libya and Syria were quite different in many respects. But there was indeed an influence of what had happened in Egypt in particular because there was the US-backed military leader. But in Syria, I got curious about it because I know that violence doesn't come from nowhere, and I know that peaceful protests don't go out and suddenly produce machine guns and start shooting grenades and so on, or start sniping at people. And so when I started researching Syria, it was because of what had happened in the southern town of Daraa, that's next to Jordan and not far from Israel. Mm-hmm. What had happened there in the middle of March 2011. And the story was, and I think Human Rights Watch official sort of line is that the peaceful protest didn't shoot back for at least 6 months until September. When you go back and research that, it's completely false, completely false. The violence that began back then was started by snipers and people that had been armed by the Saudis, and the Saudis admitted this, as they admitted lots of other things that they've done. They'd armed some extremists, Salafist Muslims, around the Al-Omari Mosque in Daraa and started sniping at civilians and police. Now, the significance of that is it's exactly the modus operandi that they'd used 29 years before, in the town of Hama when there was a Muslim Brotherhood insurrection there. Exactly the same modus operandi. And that was reported back at the time. It's in Patrick Seale's biography of Hafez al-Assad, how that all happened, who the U.S. had backed to do that. Jordan and Saddam Hussein, the Saudis, a couple of the groups in Lebanon. So it was a repeat. The Syrians knew what was going on at that time, but in the Western media we had this line that peaceful protests for at least 6 months, and then the Western narrative goes, finally, you know, their patience run out, they took up weapons to defend themselves because the army was attacking these people. Even the Syrian government hid that to a certain degree at the start. It's emerged because they were trying to sort of not let the situation get out of hand. They hid the fact that quite a number of soldiers were being killed in March and April 2011 because they were trying to stop the inflammation of
The Syrian government seemed to take a strategy of let's keep this thing kind of under wraps and see if we can calm it down, right? And And their enemies exploited that.
Yeah, so both sides were playing it down at that time. You know, still the funerals of all those people were happening, the funerals of the soldiers and so on, all these things reported at the time. I think the spin that was done then by the man that you mentioned, Rami Abdul Rahman, who runs the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights in Coventry in England, the spin there was that these were, the soldiers that were being killed were defectors that the army themselves was killing. That was a rubbish story and it was discredited by a number of people at the time. But nevertheless, it was very powerful, as you say, with the barrel bombings. They keep repeating those stories, peaceful protesters, peaceful protesters. They didn't take arms till 6 months. No, they began it, and there were independent witnesses now, like the late Jesuit priest in Homs, Father Franz.
Now, this was a priest who himself was killed at the hands of these terrorist elements.
That's right. He was killed two and a half years later on. By those groups, which are, by the way, I just read this morning in our time, afternoon, evening, your time, that the U.S. has just dropped 50 tons of weapons to the groups that the Syrian army and the Russians are fighting in northern Syria at the moment. So these are the same people that killed Father Franz in Homs back then. But anyway, he was one of those witnesses back at the time. He said, no. These extremist Islamist groups from the beginning were using violence, and that's why the army security forces responded with violence at that time. And then what happened at that time is important, but there were really two things going on. There was indeed a protest movement. There was a political reform movement, but the Islamist insurrection effectively derailed it, pushed it off the streets, because you don't go and do peaceful protests when there's bullets flying in the streets. So there were two things, and they really hijacked that from the beginning. And so, for example, when I visited Damascus and a couple of months ago, I've got a number of friends who went to some of those protests back in 2011 because they wanted some things changed about the system. But as soon as they saw that it was an Islamist insurrection, they went back and sided with either with the government or with the state, with the army. The support for the army in Syria is very, very strong, even stronger than the support for the government. So those people that were protesting at that time wanted political reform. Some of the parties joined the coalition government that now exists there, basically. There's a number of ministers who are from non-Ba'ath parties there. But the insurrection pushed that protest movement off the street within a matter of weeks.
By the way, again, it's Tim Anderson and his articles in Global Research. The last question is based on the article Daraa, if that's the proper pronunciation, 2011, Syria's Islamist Insurrection in Disguise. You know, two culprits here who don't get, seem to be called out or mentioned in the Western media. Beyond, I mean, we, of course, people are aware of the U.S. role now, very visible, but why aren't we reminded more that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are deeply committed to trying to destroy the sovereign government of Syria and say so openly?
Yeah. Well, it seems like the U.S. is pretty much in that camp now. It wasn't to begin with, but as I say, with the latest delivery of arms and their complaints about what the Russians are doing now, saying, oh, these are our rebels, you know, go and attack these other ones over here. There's some fundamental difference between these rebels and those rebels. But you're right, when it comes to the Saudis and the Qataris, there's never been any secret, really, that they support all of them. So they're allies of the U.S. in this whole operation, really what's been a failed attempt at regime change in Syria. Clearly it's failed, but they're still able to carry out enormous destruction and havoc in Syria at the expense mainly of the Syrian people. It's quite surprising if you see the U.S. Vice President Biden, the head of the U.S. Armed Forces, Martin Dempsey, who else, the guy on the Senate...
McCain?
They all admit that the Saudis and the Qataris and Turkey have supported ISIS. You know, all of those armed groups in Syria are supported by the U.S. and its allies, all of them.
Yes.
There isn't one that's out of the picture. But still, in the sort of the current of corporate media line is that there's still some distinction between the extremists and what they keep calling the moderate rebels.
Yeah. There are no moderate rebels, are there? I haven't seen anybody. Once in a while in Canada, we get introduced to one, but he always disappears.
Yeah. Well, I mean, before ISIS became the big sort of bogeyman in Syria, they'd been in Iraq for a number of years, of course, but back in early 2013, I remember I just quoted the New York Times, which has been very anti-Syrian government, saying that there, you know, you can't find any moderate rebel in Syria back at that time. Now, with the rise of ISIS, somehow there is this, they've kept it going, the idea that there is other people there. And yet we know, again, publicly, that their attempts to keep their own sponsored rebels as a distinct force has failed, because there's just a litany of stories of these various groups that they directly aren't. The U.S. has directly armed and funded, that have defected to Jabhat al-Nusra and to ISIS, basically. And it happens so often and happens at such a scale that we can only assume that the pay is better, basically, that they're being paid more to join Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS compared to the other groups. So I just compiled a list of defections in over 2013 to 2015, and there was something like 10,000 that were reported in the media, like 1,000 here, 2,000 there, 3,000 there, defecting with their anti-tank weapons, all of the other sorts of weapons that they've been given to the extremist groups. So there's a process there that's really been carefully
cultivated. And the gentleman who's in charge of the tap doesn't turn it off. We have this, the great Toyota mystery. You must be watching that one, where someone said, how come ISIS has all these lovely Toyotas? And they said, well, we're looking into that. And they said, well, you don't have to look very far, because the U.S. State Department bought a bunch of Toyotas for the moderates.
Yeah.
But every time we see those Toyotas, there seem to be men with black flags and holding human heads.
Yeah, well,
they are a cynical bunch, aren't they?
They are a cynical bunch. There's no doubt, there's no dispute that most of the weapons that ISIS has are U.S. weapons. There's no dispute about that. But there are all these cover stories how they got them, you know, that they stole them from the Iraqi army, and they accidentally picked up airdrops that were designed for someone else and so on, or, you know, that these moderate rebels have defected to them and took their weapons with them and so on, you know. This sort of stuff just doesn't happen during war, you know. It doesn't happen accidentally in that sort of way. You don't arm your supposed enemy. You know,
not when you have a command that doesn't want it to happen.
That's right, yeah.
We're speaking with Tim Anderson. Go ahead, I'm sorry. I interrupt.
I'm sorry. No, there is a degree. There is a sense in which what the U.S. calls, you know, the coalition against ISIS, the one that's done very little in a year, done less than what the Russians did in a week or so, but there is a sense in which they were bombing ISIS, or at least I call it like the cattle prod approach to bombing ISIS. In other words, you know, you steer them in another direction, because when they attack Kobani, the Kurdish partly Kurdish area in North Syria, and also the Yazidi area in North Iraq, they were indeed trying to steer ISIS away from areas where they had collaborators. Basically, some of the Kurdish leadership have been cooperating with the U.S. and getting some support from the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
you know, at the cost of some tensions with Turkey and so on. But when they've been in eastern Syria, of course, there hasn't been a single U.S. plane that stopped them going to Deir ez-Zor or going to Palmyra. They went across hundreds of kilometers of open desert to take over that ancient city of Palmyra, you might remember. There was not a single complaint from any of the U.S. coalition there. And they were acting in coordination, too, with the other rebels that had come in from the north. I mean, the other al-Qaeda groups that had come in from the north into Idlib, but currently being fought by the Syrians and the Russians in northern Syria. Mm-hmm. So there's been also a fair degree of evidence. I've put some of it together recently on the collaboration between the remnants of the old Free Syrian Army and ISIS. For example, when they took over Manag Air Base near Aleppo, for example, for several months the so-called Free Syrian Army and ISIS fought together to take it over. So this sort of collaboration is ignored when the US, as they did today, just delivered another 50 tons of weapons to the moderate rebels. They do more often than not coordinate and work with what are called the extremist groups, then squabble with them. There are squabbles between those groups, of course. There are power struggles. It has something to do with the tensions between the people who've got their hands on the tap, as you say, their sponsors. There are some differences between Turkey and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, of course. But the main body of what they're doing is collaborative. Still trying to destroy the Syrian state, to overthrow the Syrian government.
Yes. And again, we're speaking to Tim Anderson. I want to ask two questions in one. One is that this matter of where all these elements come from, that by the thousands, they seem to be funneled through Turkey. The United States talks about training them. Turkey openly talks about training people. By the way, all in violation of international law. Yeah. And President Putin of Russia said most of these people are mercenaries. He puts an interesting sort of backdrop on this, because the portrayal of them is that they're just really devout and fanatical believers. But he's suggesting a lot of them believe in money, that they are. He says they move around according to who pays. Have you looked at that, Alma, or do you think that's an accurate observation?
Yes, I have. I think it is to a degree, and certainly. Well, actually, I had a chance 2 years ago to ask one of the senior officials in the Reconciliation Ministry in Syria about this, and he was the minister there. By the way, was a non-Baathist. He was from one of the Syrian opposition parties, mm-hmm. who joined the government after the violence of 2011. And this official said, I said, you know, what about the mercenary motivation? He said, because he was telling me that some of the leaders of those groups were not particularly religious people before the crisis. Some of them were, and some of them weren't. So you've got a lot of opportunists in the leadership of these groups, because he and his department, the Reconciliation Department, were talking to them, because they've been trying for a number of years now, for three, almost 4 years now, to, under the direction of President Assad, to try and get the Syrians that are involved in this back into, you know, normal society, basically. And they have had some success. A number of thousands of Syrians have put down their weapons and basically been given some type of pardon, basically. But he was saying, yes, the mercenary thing's very strong, but you've got to remember, at the ground level, at the grassroots, you know, for the foot soldiers or the cannon fodder, whatever you want to call them, you can't underestimate the power, he said, of literally 100 television and radio stations from the Gulf, that is, say, from Qatar, mm-hmm. from Kuwait, from Saudi Arabia, from the Emirates, projecting this sectarian stuff to impressionable young people, basically. So, in other words, the religious factor, the fanatic factor, is one thing that they use to help recruit those young people, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But at the leadership level, it's very strongly conditioned by money. I mean, they wouldn't last very long without that, basically. They are selling oil, they are stealing arms, but really they have significant logistic support from all of those Gulf monarchies, for example.
Yeah, these are not ragtag elements. These people have nice the latest weapons. Tim Anderson, I want to ask you lastly, your estimate, what is going to be the impact on this? By the way, will there also be a propaganda impact of the presence of Russia now in this? Because everybody's going to have to reorient their stories, right, including a lot of Western journalists.
Yeah, well, they swung around pretty quickly to saying the same sorts of things against Russia that they were saying against Syria. But the difference is that Russia has a significant voice compared to the Syria and the Syrian media, basically. You know, they said that they were attacking the wrong people, they were killing civilians, they were killing these rebels, not those rebels or whatever. Their missiles were landing, you know, without effect and so on.
Landing in Iran. Well, maybe there could be a problem with Iran, yes.
Yeah. there wasn't really any evidence to produce, you know, to back up a lot of that. But the fact is that the Russians can speak for themselves. They've got RT, they've got a number of other media sources. So the propaganda war has sort of moved into a different phase because the Russians are able to respond to a lot of this. And, yeah, maybe they're drawing on old prejudice about the Russians in North America. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that at the same time, you've got to remember there are talks going on behind the scenes. They keep the propaganda war going on, but, for example, one thing I noticed was that the British have started funding Syrian agencies for relief, you know, because they know that their alternative is really to fund agencies linked to the government or to fund agencies linked to the al-Qaeda groups, basically. That's the choice they have. And the British have started doing it while at the same time they're publicly very aggressive. The Russians have been helping with the diplomatic process. They've been talking to the Saudis, which is important, which the Syrians don't really like to stomach, but at some stage, you know, the main organ grinders rather than the monkeys have to talk to each other, and there has to be some sort of political... Yeah, there has to be a political solution, because the Syrians have long said, so long as all these people keep getting sent from Turkey, you know, we can't bring the war to an end, basically. If it was just something within Syria, it would be brought to an end in a few weeks. But there has to be some agreement which involves... And interesting, by the way, that Turkey has an election coming up, and there's all sorts of chaos going on in Turkey at the moment. The Turkish government's attacking the Kurds. They just bombed this peaceful demonstration in Ankara. You know, so there's a type of a political foment going on in Turkey, which may, you know, in a terrible sort of way, help the process. But there has to be some international agreement to stop the terrorism coming into Syria. I believe the Syrians won the war some time ago, a couple of years ago. But killing people, the terrorism, that can go on for a long time unless there is some international agreement.
Well, I really like all this information. Tim Anderson, thank you for writing the great articles. We look forward to more, seeing more of
Thanks
the global
very much,
research.
Bill.
Okay, doke. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. Tim Anderson. And you will find those articles of global research. I urge you to go there.